The Honorable Theodora Gyatis presiding.
Good morning, everyone. Please be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We have three cases on our oral argument calendar today, March 21st, 2024. And we will dive right in with our first case. That case is State of Minnesota versus Marvel Galveston Williams. And the case number is A230793. So attorneys, it looks like you are comfortable and settled. Just a few words before you begin your arguments this morning. You'll make your arguments from the lectern in the center of the room. Feel free to adjust that up and down so that it's a good height for you. There's a button right in the front. I'd ask that you please identify yourselves and the party that you're making the argument for, because we are making an audio recording of your arguments this morning. And we want to make sure that that audio recording preserves what happens here accurately. We're also live streaming our arguments this morning, just so that you are aware. That ends my remarks. Please feel free to take your position, counsel for appellant, and we'll hear from you when you're ready to begin. Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Christina Zahar, and I represent appellant Marvel Williams. In this case, Mr. Williams was taken advantage of when he relied on an under-the-table purported promise his attorney relayed to him and counseled him on, which convinced him to plead guilty in all three felony charges he was facing. The most serious of these charges he pled guilty to was the legally impossible crime of aiding and abetting third-degree depraved mind murder, to which he was sentenced to 291 months in prison.
Well, I'm going to ask you a question right away, because you started out your argument by saying that he relied on an under-the-table promise. How are we as an appellate reviewing court to know whether there was any such under-the-table agreement or promise? I mean, this is something that any defendant could raise at any time. What do we do with that?
So in this case, in the defense counsel's memorandum in support of withdrawing the guilty plea, he actually writes in that memorandum what this under-the-table or behind-the-scenes agreement or conversation was. And the state, in their memorandum, agrees to the existence of such conversations that occurred.
Are memorandums evidence, though?
They are a part of the record in this case for this court to review, and it is a de novo review based on manifest injustice.
But do they constitute evidence that the court can consider, or are they simply assertions of counsel made in a legal document?
I suppose they're more assertions of counsel, but what I would say in this case is unique is that it's undisputed assertions of counsel, in that both parties agreed that these conversations were having place off the record.
But then we look at the colloquy between the defendant entering his plea, the appellant entering his plea, and being questioned about, is this the totality, and it being introduced as a straight plea. How do we dismiss that? Because that counters any claim that he has to something under the table.
Sure, and that's a great point to bring up. The problem we have in these plea withdrawal cases is that the plea on the record is always going to involve agreement to those rights that are being waived.
Of course, but before proffering a plea, you take an oath to tell the truth, and then you're questioned. And questioned in this case, not only by an attorney, but by a judge in terms of the, is this the agreement that you've reached? You understand this is a straight plea.
That's correct. And what we know from the memorandum is that his attorney was actually counseling him to do so, which is a part of our ineffective assistance of counsel claim, in that his attorney was counseling him to accept this agreement because it's not as it appears, essentially, that we do have a behind-the-scenes promise or agreement
from the state. But again, I think my difficulty is that I think you've agreed that a memorandum that counsel submits in a case is not evidence. And so what are we to rely upon in determining what the facts are in this case, given that there was no hearing. I don't think there was a hearing requested. There was no post-conviction hearing requested. So, in terms of what the evidence is that is truly before this court, there's nothing. I mean, would you agree with that?
I would agree with that. There was no hearing requested, as far as I can tell from reviewing the record in this case. And of course, trial counsel was not arguing that he was ineffective, which we're in a different position at this point where we are making that argument.
But aren't you, as appellate counsel, arguing that trial counsel was ineffective, obligated? I mean, don't you have the burden to create a factual record for this court to review as to counsel's ineffectiveness?
Are you talking about like a post-conviction relief hearing?
Yeah.
Yeah, this case could, I suppose, as a resolution, be remanded for an evidentiary hearing. This is not an issue that was raised on post-conviction relief, because it was also available on direct appeal, is our position. And that's the reason we are appealing it as part of a de novo review for manifest injustice.
Help my memory here. Is this a case where the deal that was not a part of the record was to have some leniency with the judge in terms of the sentencing or the outcome?
The state was going to have leniency.
But
in
if
there.
That is the case, the significance of that is any deal with the lawyers is not binding on the judge. I mean, unless that's a specific part of the plea. So, I mean, even if we accept his argument, we say, oh, yeah, there was discussion, the judge was going to be lenient. The judge in this case sentenced within, and that's your other argument, I understand that, sentenced within the provisions as far as guidelines. But how can you maintain that even that such a deal could be binding on the court? Because the court doesn't have to accept that kind of a plea.
I understand that, and I'm sure the counsel understood that too, but the person who is indicated did not understand that is Marvell Williams, and he is the person who is suffering this extreme prison sentence as a result of that misunderstanding.
But again, we don't have a record to show even that he didn't understand, right? I mean, we don't have an affidavit from him. We don't have a post-conviction hearing transcript where he testified about his understanding. So, how can we, on this very underdeveloped record, make any conclusions about, you know, what he was thinking, what the attorney was thinking, what anyone had on their minds at the time of the plea?
Yep, this court is correct. We just have those memorandums. We don't have the testimony, and perhaps that is, at least on this issue, if it's necessary, part of the appropriate resolution here is to remand for an evidentiary hearing to gather more information on what the attorney's mindset was, what was counseled to Mr. Williams, and what he understood and why he relied on his counsel to enter into this agreement. If the court is ready to move on to the third degree depraved mind murder, whether you can aid and abet that crime, that's the next topic I would like to discuss. Mr. Williams was convicted of that offense, of course, but in this case, he was so attenuated from the principal actor of the homicide, it is impossible for him to have aided and abetted that person's mindset at the time of the death of victim AM.
Well, didn't he admit to being next to the driver of the car and also to encouraging and advising the driver of the car to catch up to the car they were chasing down? And didn't he also admit to encouraging others at least to fire shots at that car they were chasing?
He did. He was the passenger in the second vehicle involved in the chase. And he did, as part of his guilty plea, agree to statements that he encouraged that driver to drive fast. However, that is still not the principal actor of the third degree murder. The principal actor of the third degree murder is the driver of the first vehicle who actually struck and killed AM. So Mr. Williams, in other words, needed to have aided and abetted his driver, who then aided and abetted the other driver in evincing a depraved mind that resulted in the death of AM, and that is just logically impossible.
So help me understand why the driver of the car that appellant was in had to necessarily be the individual who, you know, committed the act that resulted in the death. Where are you, what's the source of that argument? You're saying he wasn't the principal actor. What's the Correct. Source of that? What's the legal source of that argument?
The legal source of that is the depraved mind murder statute itself, as well as the jury instructions. And so the person, according to the statute, needs to be the person who causes the death of another. And to cause in the jury instructions for this offense requires that there be no superseding event or act that causes the death of that person. And so what we know is the superseding event that would prevent Mr. Williams' driver from being the principal actor is the fact that it was a different car with a different driver that struck AM and ultimately killed her, placing that person as the principal actor under the statute. The statute also requires that the principal cannot have the intent to affect the death of any person. That is another flaw with Mr. Williams' guilty plea in that he agreed to statements that he was trying to kill or help others in killing Mr. Elmore, the driver of the other vehicle. If a person has an intent to kill a specific person, they cannot be charged or convicted of the crime of third-degree depraved mind murder. This is, again, from the language of the statute.
Can a person have two types of intent at the same time? Can a person have an intent to kill one person and also be acting in an incredibly reckless fashion?
They can, but that is not third-degree murder. And so third-degree murder specifically requires without intent to affect the death of any person. And so perhaps it was would more appropriately be second-degree murder in that you're not intending to kill any person, but you are committing or attempting to kill a commit a felony offense. So in other words, you're committing the felony offense of attempted murder when you kill unintentionally another person. That is the more appropriate offense for that type of conduct. But third degree murder specifically requires no intent whatsoever to kill any person. You simply have the intent to act recklessly and you have a mindset. There's actually a mens rea requirement that you are evincing a depraved mind while you are committing that reckless act. And so it is actually that mindset, the mens rea element, that a person cannot aid and abet. You can aid and abet a person to act recklessly and commit that reckless act, but you cannot aid and abet a person to evince a depraved mind. That is a mens rea, mental state, subjective requirement of the individual actor.
And what is your authority for that proposition, that you can't aid and abet a person to act in a reckless fashion?
So this is a matter of first impression for Minnesota courts. This has never been argued, and we could not find any history of anyone being convicted of aiding and abetting third-degree depraved mind murder. So as far as we know, Mr. Williams, at least according to case law, is unique in that position, and it has not been addressed by any Minnesota courts. And so,
but isn't your argument similar to the argument that was made in the case, the state site, State v. Johnson? And why shouldn't we follow a similar analysis in this? Understanding it's a non-precedential case, but why shouldn't we follow a similar analysis in this case?
State v. Johnson is not at all applicable or similar to third-degree murder with a depraved mind, and that is because there is no mens rea requirement for third-degree murder by controlled substance. It's simply required that you sell or give a controlled substance without the intent to kill someone, but that person dies after consuming that substance. There's no mens rea requirement at all in that offense. You simply commit the act and a person dies, and you are then guilty of the controlled substance murder, where depraved mind murder has that additional element of the mens rea, in other words, evincing a depraved mind while you are committing the reckless act. And that is not an element in the controlled substance murder. So it's not at all analogous to this type of offense that really hinges on that mens rea requirement. Are you struggling with that?
No.
Okay. I can address further perhaps, but
I'd like you in your time remaining, I really want to talk about the sentence that was imposed by Judge Reyes in this case. And I say that because in reading the transcript, it appears that the judge, he actually said, I've thought about this for a long time, and he considered a variety of factors, but your argument falls short because you're arguing about a failure to depart, but a judge doesn't have to depart. And I can't follow your argument because the sentence was within the presumptive sentencing range. I mean, granted, it was at the top of the box, but why would we substitute our discretion, the district court's discretion, why would we substitute that? I mean, this is something Judge Hoy has heard.
He did. Yes, that's correct. And here our argument is that there's no logical way to treat Mr. Williams at the same level of serious as a typical offender of third degree murder, given his attenuated position in this offense. So in other words, being a passenger in a vehicle that was chasing another vehicle that killed a human being.
That's what he was convicted of, and that is why we have a sentencing guideline, so that we have a range and the trial court can decide if in fact the range is an appropriate outcome, which happened here.
It did happen here, but without the court actually considering these mitigating circumstances in this case. And so the court failed to consider the...
Does the court have to... I mean, you're suggesting that the court didn't consider the circumstances. Are you suggesting that the district court has to make a record of all of the mitigating circumstances considered? Can't that be something that just happens in the judge's head that doesn't make it onto the page?
And I'm gonna pile on because Judge Hoya says, quote, "And I've thought about this for a long time, Mr. Williams. I've thought about this sentence and it's sad to be here." That to me says the judge didn't just come in, pick up a file and not even know who the defendant was. The judge was fully aware of the facts and circumstances.
Thank you.
And
May
the
I
piling
answer?
On has made us run over time, but I will give you a chance to answer
you.
The multiple questions that are before you.
Thank
Go
you.
Ahead.
So what I would present in response to that is that in this case, the judge not only went significantly above the recommendation of the state, but he did so based on conduct or facts that are already accounted for in what Mr. Williams pled guilty to. So in other words, his criminal history and for, quote, involvement in the offense, which of course is pleading guilty to the offenses, being involved in it. So those are the factors that the court provided on the record. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal should you choose to. Thanks for your argument.
Good morning. May it please the court, counsel. My name is Dakota Lemuel, certified student attorney, appearing under the supervision of Adam Petrus, assistant Hennepin County attorney. Together we represent the respondent in this matter of the state of Minnesota. With my time today, I'd like to address 3 points. First, I'd like to address appellant's argument with respect to third degree depraved mind murder. Then I'd like to address the validity of appellant's plea. And then I'd like to address appellant's sentence. Aiding and abetting third degree depraved mind murder requires essentially that the appellant encourage the principle and conduct that amounts to recklessness. It essentially requires that the appellant have the knowledge that the principal is engaging in criminal behavior and intend to aid them in engaging in that behavior. In State versus Coleman, the Minnesota Supreme Court held that a defendant has the requisite mental state for third degree murder when circumstances show that the defendant committed an imminently dangerous act with an indifference to the loss of life that the act could cause. So the crux of appellant's argument today is that it's just impossible to aid or encourage someone to act with a depraved mind. And that is just not true. I mean, just by way of brief example, someone can play truth or dare and say, "I dare you to put this loaded gun to the skull of another person." And that is without a question an imminently dangerous act. It's encouraging someone to do something that is dangerous.
Ms. Lemuel, can you help me with what I think is probably the stickiest part of opponent's argument in this case? And that is that the case law holds that a person can't simultaneously have two mental states, an intent to kill a particular individual, and the reckless intent and depraved mind required by the third degree murder statute. Can you help me understand why that is not a problem for the state in this case?
Well, Your Honor, that's not a problem for the state in this case because the, and I believe this was also addressed in Knorr, but the concern is that the person that was killed. And so a person can act with a depraved mind, but it changes when the person ends up killing the person that they intended to kill. So in this case, yes, appellant did have the intent to kill Elmore, but the victim, AM, was ultimately the one that was killed here.
How do you respond to the argument that based on the language of the statute says you can't have the intent to affect the death of any person, and that the use of the word any means that the fact that Mr. Williams intended to kill the person in the vehicle and a different person was killed, that means that third degree murder was not the appropriate charge?
I'm sorry, Yarna, can you repeat that question for me?
Yeah, the statute says whoever, without the intent to affect the death of any person, causes the death of another. And I think that part of the argument that appellant is making today is that the use of the word any means that this wasn't the appropriate charge in this case, because what Mr. Williams admitted to was that he wanted to kill Mr. Elmore, the driver in the other car. So how could he not have been intending to cause the death of any person if that's what he admitted to in his plea colloquy? I think the state goes, or appellant goes further to say, so maybe this was second degree murder as opposed to third degree murder because of that.
Well, Your Honor, we would still maintain that appellant's conduct was to respond to Elmore shooting at him. And so in responding to Elmore, by shooting back at him, the victim was killed. The record here indicates that there had been ongoing feuds between appellant and Elmore for quite some time. There were disputes about stolen money. They had been dated. They were romantically involved with the same woman. And I believe they were also a part of rival gangs.
You're relying primarily on the holding that, as far as the third degree murder, that it only required a general indifference to human life. It didn't matter if he was going after the driver of vehicle number one or if it ended up being another person. Is that what you're arguing?
Yes, Your Honor, because the record here supports that appellant did act with reckless indifference.
So you would direct us to State versus Cruz from the Supreme Court that would support that proposition?
Yes, Your Honor. I believe we cited that also in our brief. Which takes me to my next point. Appellant's actions here, they indicate that appellant himself actually had a depraved mind. And then he essentially recruited the other individuals in his vehicle to also act with a depraved mind. The facts in the record indicate, as I mentioned before, that there had been ongoing issues between appellant and Elmore for quite some time. And appellant's actions with respect to what happened in the car clearly indicate that he encouraged the driver of the vehicle to drive at excessive speeds. The speed limit posted in that area, I believe, was 35 miles per hour. And so the driver of the Range Rover is driving, I believe, in excess of 90 miles per hour. That's faster than what is permitted on an open highway. He's driving that fast in city limits. And then he's also encouraging the people in his car to shoot their weapons outside the window in a congested area in town. And I mean, that certainly put the members of the public in danger, but it also put the people in the vehicle in danger, because driving that fast is inherently dangerous. And then, of course, I know there's appellant has argued that his conduct in the separate vehicle is somehow attenuated from the victim's death. But had appellant not responded the way that he did by immediately chasing Elmore and firing weapons at him, this would not have occurred. Because essentially, appellant's response, responding in kind, it set into motion a chain of events that escalated this situation much further.
Was the conduct of the other driver, the driver who ultimately crashed into the victim in this case, was that conduct a superseding event in your view?
No, Your Honor. The conduct of the other driver is a substantial, my apologies. The conduct of appellant is a substantial part of the other driver's conduct. And so this is similarly addressed in Johnson, which we cited in our brief. In Johnson, the appellant raised a similar argument about the mens rea, but also essentially suggesting that his conduct was attenuated from the death of the victim in that case. But in that case, this court noted that that Johnson's facilitation of the sale of the drugs played a substantial part in the victim's death. And the same is true here. So it's a different instrumentality, yes. But ultimately, the conduct of the appellant mirrors that of Johnson in that it would not have occurred had appellant not immediately pursued Elmore in the other vehicle. Next, I'd like to address the validity of appellant's plea agreement. Most of appellant's argument is that appellant was induced into pleading because of an agreement. And as Your Honor correctly pointed out, there...
Could I start with an initial question, which is, I think this case is some... We usually see these Rule 15 cases coming to us where there's already been a sentence, and so we have to apply the manifest injustice standard. Here this motion was filed prior to sentencing, and so I'm interested in what, and so it's a more lenient standard in terms of allowing plea withdrawal, I think, than manifest injustice. And so could you speak briefly on what the prejudice would have been to the state had the district court allowed plea withdrawal in this case, since that's an element of the fair and just standard?
I believe the prejudice would be probably, I think this case had a lot of issues in it with proffering and other people, prosecuting other people. And so I think that it would have been difficult for the state to prosecute the case because of witnesses and additional time. And I believe there was like a 10-month gap between the acceptance of appellant's plea and when the plea was given and appellant's sentencing. So I think that it would have just prejudiced the state by causing it to have to spend a substantial amount of time to prosecute the case and also gather witnesses and things like that. Going back to the agreement, as Your Honor pointed out, there is not an agreement. There's no evidence of an agreement. And what actually happened is there were just generalized discussions that are typical of a defense attorney and a prosecutor, where the state essentially said that they would not seek a sentence that was higher than the bottom of the box. And that was based on discussions of appellant proffering.
Well, Ms. Lemuel, that position is asserted by your office in the memorandum filed in response to the motion to withdraw a plea, but would you agree that we don't have any evidence either way as to what happened?
Yes, Your Honor, that is my point. There is no agreement because there wasn't an agreement. There's no proof in the record.
Okay, and it sounds to me that today Ms. Zahara is suggesting that the case should be remanded for some kind of an evidentiary hearing. What is your response to that?
Well, we would disagree with that because there was no agreement. There's no evidence of an agreement. And I understand that she has argued that appellant received no benefit from the agreement that doesn't exist. But something I'd like to point out is that in this case, on April 1st, a month before the trial, the state filed the notice to seek an aggravated sentence. But after the trial started, after jury selection, appellant entered a straight plea. So at that point in time, the state had no control over what the judge would decide for a sentence. And as Your Honor also pointed out, appellant was asked multiple times by the judge, by his counsel, and by the state that he understood there was no agreement. So I think remanding it would not help show that there was an agreement, because there never was one.
What effect should we give the fact that appellant didn't request any hearing in connection with the motion to withdraw filed in the district court? In other words, should we hold that against appellant and say, you know, you forfeited the ability to create an evidentiary record here to support your claim that you threw out in a memorandum? Or is that remedy unfair?
No, Your Honor, we don't believe that it's unfair, but it certainly doesn't bolster their argument that an evidentiary hearing is required, because there was certainly an opportunity to request a hearing when the initial motion was filed. And so it doesn't help them in any way to now ask for one after the fact, because the result would ultimately be the same. There is no evidence of any agreement ever existing. Finally, I'd like to address, actually, my apologies. I'd like to address briefly with my time, appellant's remarks about leading questions. I understand that this court generally disfavors leading questions when accepting a plea, but no plea. This Minnesota Supreme Court held in Nelson that it has never invalidated a plea simply because it was the form of the questions was disfavored. And I'd also like to reiterate that appellant does not contend that any of his admissions were inaccurate. He doesn't say that his plea is inaccurate. He just says that he takes issue with the form of the questions. Right. Thank you for your time. We ask that this court affirm appellant's convictions. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your argument. And now we will go back to counsel for appellant. You'll have 5 minutes.
Thank you. I want to point out a few facts that are in the record that indicate Mr. Williams relying on something that doesn't exist in the record due to the shortcomings of his attorney. Not only did he receive no benefit from this non-agreement.
Well, in a way he did, though. At sentencing, Judge Hoyas commented on the fact that he stepped up, I think he said, accepted responsibility and stepped up, and he was referring to the straight-up plea. So that's a benefit. At least it was a consideration by the judge as to the disposition, the sentence.
Well, it's not a benefit when you got maximum sentence.
But how do we know that wasn't the objective? How do we know that a trial tactic isn't a lawyer saying, look, plead straight up, save the trial rigors, and it may, in fact, impress the judge, as it did, that he took responsibility? Isn't that something?
That is something, that can be something.
So how do we know then that trial strategy wasn't a part of guiding this defendant to enter a straight up plea?
The clues that we have on the record is that Mr. Williams turned down many, many plea offers throughout the history of this case.
And that always happens until you have a jury looking at you. I guess that's not a question.
Sure, but the state was offering less than 100-month sentences previously, and now there's a jury looking at him, and there's apparently no agreement whatsoever.
What works against your argument is having a judge that is trying to be so thorough on a case that he says specifically to Mr. Williams, do you understand there is no agreement really as to what the sentence will be in this case? That will be up to me in the future. Do you understand? And your client says yes. And that's followed up by questions from his attorney. Do you understand there's no deal? And he says yes. I think that's the biggest obstacle you have in this case, absent any other evidence.
It is the biggest obstacle that we have. And it's often or almost always the biggest obstacle that exists in a plea withdrawal case or request, especially one based on ineffective assistance of counsel, because due to the nature of ineffective assistance, it's often not going to be in evidence and on the record. And so we kind of look for those gaps or holes in the logic of what occurred in the case, for those clues that counsel was ineffective or may have been advising him to do something behind the scenes that wasn't to his benefit.
But do you agree with the state that you could have asked for an evidentiary hearing associated with this Rule 15 motion to more further develop the record?
Not myself. Trial counsel could have. Trial counsel could have requested an evidentiary hearing. Yes, their motion specifically said they're not requesting a hearing, and they simply submitted their signed memorandum of law instead.
And trial counsel could have also submitted an affidavit from your client indicating, there were opportunities to, we don't need to just look at clues. There were opportunities to develop the record on this issue, and they simply weren't done here.
That's absolutely correct. And that's a perfect example of how Mr. Williams is being punished for the shortcomings of his counsel. That goes directly to the point of ineffective assistance of counsel, that there was this alarming issue or something that should have raised alarm in the judge reading these memorandums, but his attorney did not even present any form of evidence in support of that plea withdrawal. And Mr. William is now being punished because of those shortcomings and those decisions of his attorney, who by the memorandum clearly was trying to dig himself out of some kind of hole from what he was advising his client to do behind the scenes. This is also apparent to me because of the factually confusing plea that ended up being entered, in that Mr. Williams agreed that he was trying to kill Mr. Elmore. He was telling other people to kill Mr. Elmore. He was telling people to chase Mr. Elmore. Yet he had a gun in his possession and did not fire it. That logically does not make sense with these facts that he is admitting to based on these leading questions during the guilty plea. It's illogical when you look at the evidence of the case and what he actually did or did not do. It is uncontradicted that Mr. Williams had a gun, and it's uncontradicted that he did not ever fire that gun in the course of this chase from one vehicle to the other. And so ultimately the point is, I think that indicates that he was simply answering yes to these leading questions, even in a manner that did not make sense to or was contrary to the evidence that was in the case, which would indicate his following the advice that his attorney may have told him. Thank you for your time.
Thank you both for your arguments this morning. The case is now submitted to us, and we will issue our decision within the statutory time frame, which in this case is 90 days. Thank you. Thank you.